So crises don't always move at the speed of light. You know, sometimes they do, but sometimes there is a little flare up and then a pause and then a little flare up and then another little pause and then a whole bunch of flare ups and it gets really bad. So I don't know the answer. I do know that the system as we have it is wildly unstable, and it's unstable both in a financial sense and in a bigger sort of societal and policy driven stance.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. The systems that run our economy are only as good as the people running them. With hot inflation, the recent debt ceiling standoff, bank failures, and scandals like FTX, it's understandable to wonder if we couldn't find better leaders than the ones we currently have in place. Which is why we're very fortunate to have Bethany McLean join us on the program today. A Slate columnist and contributing editor for Vanity Fair, Bethany worked for 13 years as editor-at-large at Fortune, where she and fellow reporter Peter Elkind exposed the Enron scandal. She is also the nationally best-selling co-author of The Smartest Guys in the Room and All the Devils Are Here, books that were exposés that dug deep into the global financial crisis and business ethics, which make her a perfect expert for today's topic on leadership. Bethany, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Bethany, really appreciate you joining. I know you are fresh off the efforts of getting a new book off to the publisher. Congratulations. I know that's a Herculean amount of work these days. A lot of questions here for you. If we can, I'd just like to start with the general one I like to ask all my guests at the beginning of these discussions. What's your current assessment of today's economy and financial markets?
Well, it's a fascinating question because I think you could argue just about anything you want to argue, right? I mean, we sit on the precipice of it could go either way. You could make a case that things are pretty good. First, earnings came in better than people were expecting them to be. It looks like the Fed is beginning to get inflation under control. Maybe we'll get that soft landing where the Fed gets inflation under control and we don't slump into a recession. The gap in income has closed for the first time in a long, long, long time. You have those at the bottom end of the spectrum doing really well doing better than they have in a long time relative to those at the top. And you have plenty of jobs. So you could make a really bullish argument for the U.S. You could also make a really bearish case, which is that corporations have been able to raise profits in the face of inflation, and that's to some degree leading to the good results that we are indeed headed into a recession. That the inflation numbers still aren't great, and the Fed has missed the call on inflation all along, and that as the pandemic era fades, that these gains that we've seen for people at the bottom end of the income distribution are going to evaporate if we head into a recession and layoffs continue. So I don't know. Basically, I could make an argument either way.
Okay, if I could sum up, then it sounds like you're saying we're sort of at a juncture point here, and I guess intimating we'll find out, you know, at some point here which way we go down, the sunnier route or the darker route.
Uh-huh. I think so. I think I had said precipice, but that's the wrong word. What I'm really trying to think of is sort of like the continental divide. there are big swaths of possibilities on either side of this line that we're perched on right now, or this divide that we're right now.
So we'll dig into a few of those. But just to start here, you know, your work largely centers around the people who are running our systems, whether it's the financial system, the banking system. I know your new book deals with sort of the response to the pandemic and whatnot. And as I said in the intro, you know, any system is really only as good at the end of the day as the people who are running it. And you know, you've done what I would sort of consider to be sort of exposés, you know, in the past, where, you know, you've revealed that a lot of times the smartest guys in the room you know, weren't necessarily the smartest guys in the room. And I'm curious, you know, at a high level here, would you say, and I don't maybe I'll deliberately use extreme words just to give you something to react to. But would you say that we have sort of a crisis of leadership today in terms of, has the system gotten to a place where it has become so captured that it is largely being run by the folks running the system for the benefit of those at the top and kind of the corporate cartels and whatnot, more so than the people? And sort of that's why we keep getting surprised with, you know, all the excesses that led to the global financial crisis, or, all of a sudden a really strong looking bank like Silicon Valley Bank all of a sudden goes under in a matter of 48 hours. And we realize there was a ton of rot there and poor risk management processes that apparently nobody saw coming, right? So would you say that we are at a point right now where our leadership is failing us and maybe perhaps we need, some pretty substantial reforms, or am I overstating things here?
I think you might be overstating things. I don't think it's that dire. I think there are a lot of good people out there who are well-intentioned. I do think we've reached this moment in capitalism. And for as much as for as much as there's this very American belief in the glories of the free market, there's really no such thing, right? Any market is dependent on the rules that are set down. And the problem with a capitalist society where money speaks power is that increasingly the rules are weighted toward those who are in power, or those who know how to write the rules so that they can continue to make money. And then people turn around and say, it's the free market, except it isn't. The financial crisis is the global financial crisis of 2008 is example number one, right? The financial system got bailed out in the end, and ordinary homeowners did not. And so that's mm-hmm. that has caused, I think, a lot of cynicism in American life. I think about the financial crisis as being primarily, all these years later, a societal crisis rather than a financial crisis, in the sense that we fixed the financial part of it by throwing lots of money at it. But it left this growing cynicism about the way the world works, to your point.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but it also left a wide and for a long while accelerating wealth gap too,
yes,
where that money we threw at it didn't go evenly into people's pockets. Yeah.
Right. And precisely. And that's because of the Fed's response to the financial crisis, not just because of the Fed's response to the financial crisis, but the Fed's ongoing response over that next decade, which was to keep interest rates super low, which of course inflates asset prices, and the inflation in asset prices primarily benefits the wealthy. I don't think the Fed, by the way, was doing it to make the wealthy wealthier. I think the Fed was trying to fix unemployment. So I think the Fed was basically well-intentioned. It's just that the only medicine they had happened to have a very deleterious side effect. But I worry a lot about that. I worry a lot about the way the rules are being set and the forces that are setting those rules. I think they are less the specific people in power than they are kind of the big shadowy forces out there mm-hmm. that often make things happen behind the scenes that we don't really see. And then I think the other side of it that I worry about is all of us. And maybe, there's an argument when you look back to the very start of America and the amount of anger and, civil war, for heaven's sakes, that our divides today, perhaps to say we're more divided than we've ever been is a little bit of an overstatement, but nonetheless, we are all forgetting how to listen to each other. And maybe we never knew, but that makes it also really hard for people to have any power when we're all susceptible to whatever narrative being put forward by the people in power that divides us rather than unites us.
Yeah. All right. So just to dig on this a little bit, because I sort of got more affirmation from your answer than maybe intended. But
even when I'm trying to be positive, I can't be positive.
Yeah. And just to clarify too, like my question wasn't like, is there a group of mustache twirlers that are, planning, world domination at the expense of everybody else? But I sort of use that term captured, right? Which you sort of said yourself, that as money gets concentrated, the pools that it concentrates in, they then use that money to continue to write the rules to their ongoing advantage, right? And it just becomes an increasingly sort of unfair system as those who just sort of human nature. It's our human nature is to try to advance our own interests, right? Where you end up with either, you know, the top 1%, or whether it's the corporations that have, you know, in many cases, this is my words, you don't have to agree with them, but I feel like it's hard to look at a sector of the economy now that doesn't kind of operate like a cartel, you know, with a few big companies at the top who are then investing in regulations and whatnot to increase the moat between them and any potential other additional competition and whatnot. And if you sort of just run that mental model in your head, you're like, okay, well, at some point that kind of generally hits some sort of breaking point where at some point societally, maybe it's because of the wealth divide or whatnot, but where people may stand up and just say, hey, this isn't working for me anymore. We need to have some pretty big restructuring going on here yet. Don't necessarily say we're there quite yet, but it seems to be the trajectory from my perspective. And given that you kind of spend your career looking at people at the top, you know, I mean, if there's optimism and hope for kind of self-reform in these, you know, in these areas, great. I'd love for it. But, you know, as I listed a whole bunch of things at the beginning, you know, we had, again, I'm not saying it's done intentionally. It's probably done with the best of intentions, but misguided in application. You know, we've had monetary policy that I think in retrospect clearly ran hot for too long or too loose for too long. And then we got this massive inflation and we're trying to get that genie back in the bottle. And there's all the collateral damage that has created as we've had to hike interest rates faster, you know, in a shorter period of time than we ever have before. We had we've got the drama with the debt ceiling standoff, and the debt is a massive problem that we honestly just keep hand kicking. Like, we're not even really dealing with it. We had the bank failure. Like, we're just sort of seeing all these, at least from my perspective, instances where, you know, our leaders are driving things to these, I guess I'll call them breaking points or failure points or whatnot. And I don't know. Like I said, you know these people better than I do. Is there hope that we're going to get, you know, a new generation of better people running the system better, or are we just going to run till it really breaks and then people look at the rubble and say, okay, there's got to be a better way to do this going forward?
I suspect generally the latter, right? Things have to get to a breaking point before there's change. And you're right. I think that is worrisome. And I think about this loosely in two ways. There are a whole set of people for whom capitalism is not working. And it did, weirdly enough, and to the absolute contrary of the predictions that most economists had, that the pandemic was going to leave those at the bottom end of the income distribution worse off than they ever were. And those were certainly the numbers in the immediate aftermath of COVID hitting. But that's actually not what's happened. There's a lot of analysis showing that those at the bottom end of the income spectrum have done better than they have in decades in the last couple of years. And a tight labor market has certainly helped that. And so the response to the pandemic is not 100% of a response of benefiting the wealthy at the expense of the less wealthy. Yet at the same time, inflation takes a bite out of those at the bottom end far more than it does those at the top end. It's almost right. As if different sets of inflation numbers, right? I always kind of laugh when I see the headline inflation number, because I think inflation is personal, right? It depends on your budget. If you're sending your child to college, then the rising cost of higher education is hugely inflationary for you. If you're renting, the rising cost of rent is hugely inflationary. If a good portion of your income goes to milk and eggs and food, other food and gasoline, then the current environment has been really hard. So they're just, and that unfortunately does in general hit people at the bottom end of the income distribution more. And so it does seem, when you look, there have been a few things that have gone right, as I mentioned, but it does seem that most of the decisions we seem to make hurt the small and the less well-off and benefit the big. And I don't know why that happens time and time again, but you can even look at the recent banking crisis as more evidence of that. And then I think the real instability in society always comes from the slightly less well-off, who start feeling that they don't have the opportunities that the really, really well-off do. Mm-hmm. And so while nobody is crying for the top, you know, 99.9% or the top or the 99% or the 90th from the 99th percent, those people sometimes are crying for themselves. And I worry about that, the instability that comes there, because it usually is those one layer down who foment instability, who have the time to start plotting a revolution because they think that they and their children should be entitled to what the 0.1% has. And increasingly in American life, that's not true, right? There are places that aren't livable. There's education that kids can't have. There are all sorts of things. And so I worry about those two sources of instability, the people for whom capitalism really isn't working and the people who comparatively feel that capitalism isn't working for them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Can I explain that decently?
It totally does. And we've talked about this a bit on the program before, but I'd love to dig into it with you a little bit here, which is, you know, when you talk about, you know, let's talk about the bottom 90%, right? The folks that aren't close to the brass ring these days. And it's sort of asymptotic, right? I mean, the closer you get to that top 1%, your wealth just goes through the roof. There's been a lot of movement towards sort of the democratic socialism side of things. And I get it, you know, especially I'm a parent, right? I've got a child in their 20s, a child in their teens. I get the general sense that younger generations feel right now of, hey, I'm coming of age in a world where the opportunities are, as they perceive them, diminished from what previous generations had. Things are super unaffordable, especially the key elements of the American dream, the cost of education, the cost of housing, that type of thing. And so there's almost a little bit of a sense of defeatism. And there's a sense of like, look, yeah, all right, you guys tell me socialism's bad, but what we have right now isn't working out so great for me either. And I may as well vote for the guy who's promising me some free stuff along the way, even if I'm going to get screwed in the end, no matter which path we take. So, I don't want to make this about, the evils of socialism versus capitalism or whatnot, but I can definitely see that pull, right, from younger generations saying, almost like we're kind of willing to throw out the rule book of how, American society has been run because it's just not working for us anymore. And I do think that, you know, we could have some pretty large political instability at some point as that generation really comes of age and starts voting if prospects for them don't start looking better. You're sort of nodding as I'm saying all this, so I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I totally agree with that. And I think that it is worrisome. I'm pretty firmly, at least still, I'm always open to changing my mind, but I'm pretty firmly in the camp that capitalism is the best model out there with the famous words of Winston Churchill, right? As he said it about democracy, but we could say it about capitalism too. It's the worst possible way to run the economy except for everything else that's ever been tried.
Right.
But back to my point that I began with, capitalism and rabid free markets are two different, they're related, but they're different. And there really isn't any such thing as a free market. I mean, if you think about even the existence of a limited liability corporation, right? That's granted by government, granted by society, so that people can run a business without being worried about how it affects their personal liability. That's a gift from society and the government to private enterprise. It's a rule. Same as all the rules dictating what happens in bankruptcy, right? They're rules. And it's bankruptcy court and rules that make it possible for much of what we think of as the free market to function. Those are rules. So the question to me about capitalism is how we set the rules in a way that makes sense for the most people. And that's what I think we're failing to do because people have this, in some cases, because people have this ideological belief that the free market is just the free market without looking at the rules and the structures underpinning it and how those things are set up and whether they're set up to benefit the few or set up to benefit the many. And I think, an example of that, an example of how things have evolved is the pretty monomaniacal focus on the bottom line and the short-term bottom line. I'm willing to make the argument that a long-term bottom line could be aligned with society's interests, but a short-term bottom line is very clearly not. And I think people see that, and it's really problematic. And we've been talking about the dangers of short-termism, my goodness, since at least the days of Enron. I remember talking to people about it at all these conferences and on these shows. And so people were probably talking about it before I knew it. And it doesn't change. We just get more and more short-term oriented. And I think that's problematic because we can see the many ways in which being short-term oriented, people can make fortunes doing things that are clearly bad for the majority of society. And that's, you see that happening, whether in the subprime crisis where a lot of people got out with a lot of money before the proverbial four-letter word hit the fan, or you can see it happening in many other areas. And that worries me. And then there is this also broader breakdown, I think, of morality that used to govern the system. And I don't know how we get it back, because I don't believe in rules dictating everything about human society. And the best example I can come up with of that is what happened with Martin Shkreli and then the pharmaceutical company Valeant, both of whom, you know, Martin decided he could raise the price on this drug 400% or whatever the number was, because what was to stop him? It wasn't illegal. And then Valeant started doing the same thing. And then all these companies were founded to buy up existing drugs that people needed and raise the price to whatever they possibly could. And, you know, it wasn't illegal, but that never happened before. Why didn't that happen before? Because people wouldn't do it. Because they would look at it and say, ew, I'm not making my money that way. You didn't need a law to prevent it from happening. It just, companies didn't do it.
There was a social constraint. Yeah.
It was a social constraint until it wasn't. And I look at that example and I worry more broadly about the breakdown in social constraints and what that means for the future of capitalism, because some part of it has to be self-regulating based on social constraints. It can't be regulated entirely by rules and regulations. It has to be, I won't do that because I wouldn't do that, because it's not the right thing to do. And in a society that no longer seems to believe that, what happens?
So super interesting, and this isn't where I was expecting to go in the discussion, but let's stay here for a minute. So this is reminiscent of a conversation I had on this program a few weeks ago with Charles Hugh Smith, where he basically made this statement. He said, we actually have really good institutions for dealing with the problems that we face right now. We're just not using them well. And basically what he sort of deconstructed it to is he said, look, we have the public, we have the state, and then we have the market, right? And he said they're actually all really good for putting in place the conditions we want and need to solve issues or go after opportunities, but we have to be using them the right way. And the way that we sort of boil it down is it's the public's job to basically set the values. Right. It's to put into place the leaders that say, look, this is what we value as a society. Right. And then your job as the state is to put in the rules for how we're going to sort of enforce society's values. But then kind of, set the parameters, but then just be a ref. Right. Mm-hmm. And then the market is within the set parameters. It's to play the game and it's to find the solutions, right? But kept in check, enough by whatever the values that the public has set, to drive the game. And that way you hopefully don't have the price gouging of the type that you were talking about, right? And hopefully you don't have too intrusive a government, right? Where they set the minimum amount of rules to support the values and then they shift just to being a ref to make sure that no bad actors are breaking the rules too much, right? And kind of in each one of those cases, we don't really have a public, this is my opinion, you don't have to share it. We don't really have a public that's perhaps grabbing the agency they need to really hold, one, to be clear on what their values are. Because as you said, this is one of the more divided times in American history. We have a lot of dynasties and big money and still in politics. And I don't think we as a public have really, been clear on what we want and demanded that the politics shift to account for that. Yeah, again, you don't need to share that opinion. I think we have a lot of excessive government intervention in a lot of different things. And, we could start with all the endless QE programs and stuff that have been going on, but those are just one of many examples. And then, of course, we have a lot of abuses that are going on in this kind of corporate cartel-like structure that we have in the markets right now. So the fundamental point being is we have good institutions or good machinery in place. We're just not using it in the way that we could and maybe should be to writing how we want things to go. You're nodding as I'm saying this, but I don't want to imply that that's acceptance of what I'm saying. So let me give you a chance to respond.
Well, I love the framework. I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about things. And I like the idea of the tripod, Broadly speaking, I think that's it's really interesting, and I agree. You know, the more you need a lot of rules and regulations when it isn't clear, because you need the rules and regulations to try to draw to try to dot every I and cross every T when the broader frameworks aren't clear. And so the only thing I don't like about that is that it's diffuse in terms of how to fix it. Mm-hmm. I maybe we all have to be educated differently so that people understand this is our job in this thing called a functioning democracy, that with a capitalist economic system, if this is how we want it to be, this is the job we have to take. And there has to be
I would be for that. You don't have to, but I would be for that.
And there has to be agreement on the part of government, and there has to be agreement on the part of business that this is the way it works, that there isn't such a thing as an unfettered free market, that there are rules and norms and values that we all live by to make this thing work. And I think too often, I think business doesn't really get that. Their response to the challenges with capitalism is, you people who don't appreciate what you have, instead of, what can we do to stabilize this system so that we get to keep making the money, at least some degree of the money we make, so that this works for everybody and we don't have something that blows up on all of us. And I think about that. I think it's most profound in the area of healthcare, where you look at the pharmaceutical price gouging that I had mentioned, and then you look at the hospital system and the way it functions, and some of the scandals of recent years, like surprise billing, where people would go to an emergency room and not realize their ER doctor didn't take their insurance that the hospital did, and get stuck with, you know, multiple. It doesn't take much of that to break down the faith in our system. And I wish the people doing that understood the broader consequences of what they did, and that eventually it may not rebound on them, but it's for sure going to rebound on society at large if a lot of people lose faith in our system.
Yeah. And of course that's the blindness of the folks that have the advantage right now, right? Is if you just keep maniacally continuing to slant the field to your advantage, at some point the majority, and there's a lot more of them than you, wakes up one day and says, we're not taking this anymore, right? And that's when you get either social violence, or you get, you know, wealth redistributive taxes or whatever, right?
On that note, I have I do a podcast with a guy named Luigi Zingales, who's a professor at the University of Chicago.
And great podcast.
Thank you. And we had an economist named David Autor, who's an MIT economist, on our show recently. And he made the point, which I found really profound, that if you structure labor markets appropriately, then you don't have to have redistribution. So if you pay for things appropriately on the front end, then you don't have to have redistribution on the back end. And so one way of thinking about that is, we all want cheap goods, right? But then we have to redistribute, because the people who work at Walmart and Amazon and where aren't making enough of a living wage in order to cover their expenses. So wouldn't you rather just pay a better price for the thing that you're buying, so that the labor markets work appropriately? Because then people have the dignity of work, and you don't have to have as much redistribution on the back end. And I thought, oh, that makes all the sense in the world to me, that labor markets really are the key to fixing capitalism. Because if you get labor markets working right, and people can get a job where they can earn a living wage, you fix a lot of this. And I don't, it bothers me. I couldn't walk you through the intellectual underpinning for why capitalism isn't working that way anymore. I mean, I think it's a lot of short-term shareholder value oriented decisions, but it's problematic, because you would like to believe that capitalism working efficiently would make sure that everybody up and down the chain had the opportunity to make a living.
But as we can all see right now, that is breaking down. And I think there are problems on both sides, right? Which is the short-term bottom line-ism that you're talking about. But also, I think there's lots of issues with government. And I've been writing about this long before just the recent current AI, mania that's going on, where we have been providing a massive perverse incentive, or what I call a malincentive, to businesses to find ways to replace human capital, because we are making the cost of employing humans prohibitively expensive for employers. everything from, you know, mandated increases in, you know, minimum wage, which in, you know, certain states, you know, it almost went up by like 50% in the matter of a year or two in certain places, where, you know, OSHA requirements and healthcare costs and all kinds of things. And not that you don't need to have safety in healthcare, but, you know, we basically said, look, it's getting harder and more and more expensive to hire a person, and with training and legal risks and just all sorts of things. And the technological solutions for replacing them are getting cheaper and cheaper. And up until quite recently, we're making debt super cheap to take on. So there was just this massive incentive to either outsource or automate. And you know, we start then hollowing out, particularly this was hitting before AI, this was hitting the lower end of the wage scale. So we were kind of like dramatically hollowing out the onboarding process for people entering the workforce. And so, you know, labor's just been getting, you know, I think the shorter and shorter end of the stick here. But you know, to our point here, it's been both because of what's been going on the corporate short-term side, but also a lot of, you know, policy that's been going on. So to your point, like, we sort of need a reevaluation, or at least a smarter evaluation. I always kind of go back to Charlie Munger's talk about, like, show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome, right? If you can design a system and provide the right incentives, then the system should hopefully just play out and find the optimal solution. Right. But it seems like we're kind of mucking up the design and we're putting perverse incentives in play at the same time.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is really problematic, because if someone doesn't get on the work path at a pretty early stage in their life, they're never going to. They're going to miss out on developing the skills that you need. And so, but if you are going to create a class of people that doesn't work, then you have to be prepared that that's never going to change, because it's really difficult to have somebody who doesn't work for a decade and get them back on the path toward work. Yeah. I think the research also shows that it's pretty difficult for their kids as well. So I speaking of just government incentives, if we are through there's an interesting parallel between what happened with China and outsourcing so much and taking manufacturing jobs away from the US, and what might happen with AI. And most economists miss the China shock, because people didn't want to see it. Globalization was just supposed to make things cheaper. It was supposed to benefit everybody. And now at least some economists, including Autor, look back and say, oh, this was really, really disruptive to swaths of the economy in a way that was not just bad for people, it was bad for their children. And if we're going to do that again with AI and wipe out swaths of the economy, we have to be really prepared for the social consequences of that. And it's not fixable through universal basic income. That's a salve that might ameliorate some of the really terrible effects, but it doesn't fix the problem. And so I worry, like you, that we're not even capable of thinking about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, like I said, you were probably not expecting the conversation to go in this direction. I wasn't really either. Two last things before we get to what I did want to talk to you about, which was the state of the banking system, because I know that you've been covering that of late. So you talked about, you know, some of these bad actors that sort of Shkreli, like, you know, kind of made out like bandits with big short-termism on the bottom line, and how we haven't held them to account. And I'm sure you and I can create a long list, but as you were talking, I was thinking about Angela Mozillo, right? And it's a name we just haven't heard for a long time, but am I correct in thinking that guy really did kind of skate?
I think he did. So one of the things I've developed a lot more, I have so much less of a black and white view of human nature than I once did. In some ways, am I sympathetic to him? I mean, his company did propagate bad subprime loans all over the country in a desperate effort to keep up with other subprime lenders and make sure that Countrywide didn't lose market share. But it was less driven by, let me do a bad thing in order to make my money. And that's usually not the way things work. And it was much more, This is short term in some ways. This is what's happening. If I don't keep up with these bad subprime lenders and make these loans, then Countrywide is no longer going to be relevant. And my investors and board of directors are going to say, Angelo, you no longer have a job because you're not making these profits that are there to be made by making these loans. And that's what led Countrywide down that path, really. And then there's another aspect to this too, which is the reason that he was not prosecuted criminally and got off pretty lightly civilly, is that the argument was always, well, Countrywide actually disclosed all of this in their financial statements. There weren't really any secrets. When everybody said, oh my goodness, these emails from Angelo Mozzillo talking about Countrywide's credit quality, he knew. Well, of course he knew. It was right there in their financial statements. And I'm a little mixed on that argument but it for sure holds up in court. And there's another level to this, which is that I'm not so sympathetic to, which is once again the way our system works, right? The laws serve to insulate those at the top of a company because they can say, I relied on my lawyers, I relied on my accountants, I relied on my underlings, and you can't prosecute them, even if they directly benefited from the behavior of those underneath them. And that is the case with Mozzillo. He made a lot of money from Countrywide's move into subprime loans, which ended up being really bad for the country and really bad for some of his employees. I think some of them did face criminal charges or lost their jobs or whatever else. But Mozzillo, who sits at the top, gets to be protected. And it's another example of what we were talking about at the beginning, how our entire system is geared to deliver wealth to those at the top while insulating them from responsibility for their actions. And I have no problem with somebody who creates a business making a lot of money. I think that's the way it's supposed to work. When the business creates jobs and creates products that really want, and when that person ends up with a responsibility if things don't work. What I don't like is our modern system where it doesn't really have to create many jobs. I'm not even sure it has to create a product that people want. And when, once again, the four-letter word hits the fan, the person gets to keep the money and walk away from the responsibility. That seems screwed up to me.
All right. Well, that's exactly why I raised him. So I think you just laid that out very well. And perhaps that might be a good segue into talking about the banking system here. We've had three of the four largest bank failures in the U.S. in the past two and a half months or so. So a couple of questions for you. I'm trying to figure out where to go. I do want to talk about the leadership of Silicon Valley Bank. And what's interesting is I've now actually just very recently in the headlines seen some discussion that maybe there might be some sort of clawback efforts going on here, because the executives there did take out a fair amount of pay in the year plus leading up to the surprise failure of Silicon Valley Bank. But maybe before we talk about that specifically, what is the current state of the banking system? Janet Yellen even said relatively, I think just a couple of days ago, look, there may be, she called them a few more consolidations, but that's code for sort of like, hey, there may be a few more failures where a bank needs to be taken over going forward. Have we seen the worst of it, or are there more failures ahead of us here, do you imagine?
I don't know. We're in a state of like the eye of the storm right now, or a state of nervous calm where people are still nervous, but the jitters are right under the surface and everybody's saying, ah, it's calm. But that doesn't really mean anything. If you remember the global financial crisis, the tremors actually first started in the fall of 2007. They might even have started earlier, actually, in early 2007, actually, when the price of subprime mortgage-backed securities first began to plummet. And it took a good year and a half for the total catastrophe to arrive. So crises don't always move at the speed of light. You know, sometimes they do, but sometimes there is a little flare-up and then a pause, and then a little flare-up and then another little pause, and then a whole bunch of flare-ups, and it gets really bad. So I don't know the answer. I do know that the system as we have it is wildly unstable, and it's unstable both in a financial sense and in a bigger sort of societal and policy-driven stance. And by the first one, I mean that, you know, the Fed calming the panic by stepping in and guaranteeing the deposits at banks that are failing is not the way this whole deal is supposed to work, right? just stipulated. If that's the way it has to work, then something is going badly wrong. And so and it's both that the Fed is taking on a larger and larger role in our economy all the time. And it's that's not sustainable. The Fed can't. I don't think even the Fed has the firepower to guarantee deposits across the entire banking system. And the modern banking system doesn't work the way the old one does. Silicon Valley Bank is proof positive of that. And what I mean by that is that in the old days, everybody believed deposits were stable. That was your stable source of funding. And it was stable if it was business deposits, because you had relationships with these people and they weren't just going to yank their money all at once. Well, now guess what? Luigi actually has done some research with a colleague showing that it looks like consumer deposits at banks that have where you can electronically move your money really easily are mm-hmm. less stable. Because if your deposits are at a bank earning nothing and you can move them to a money market fund and earn 5%, it's easy today to do that. So that makes consumer deposits less stable. And a Silicon Valley Bank shows business deposits aren't that stable either, right? One little whisper and the herd starts to move, and then the herd stampedes. So the old rules of banking clearly don't apply, which is why I say the system is unstable financially. But I think it's also unstable more broadly, because what we've done every time a crisis has hit is make the big bigger, right? We did mm-hmm. it in the global financial crisis, and we're doing it now. And I think I respect Jamie Dimon more than about any business leader out there. If you had to have somebody running a large swath of the country's banking system, you'd want it to be Jamie Dimon. But do you want somebody running a large swath of the country's banking system? I'm not sure. It flies in the face of everything we've always said of what our supposed policy is. And our supposed policy is small banks and small businesses. And if you don't have small banks anymore, then at some point you don't have small businesses anymore, because a JP Morgan Chase is not going to make a $50,000 loan to the local carpentry store, the local, hardware store. And so what do we want as a country? Do we want small banks and small businesses, or do we want everything to be dominated by the big? And nobody seems to be willing to reckon with everything we do to bail out an unstable system makes the big bigger at the expense of the small. Is that where we're going? Is that where we want to go? Maybe you can make an argument that that's where we should go. I don't think so. But at least let's make that argument instead of just doing it and then living with the consequences.
Right. And I wonder if this isn't yet another example of what we talked about at the very beginning, of those who have increasingly captured the system just continuing to centralize their advantage more and more, right? So too big to fail becomes too bigger to failer, right? Just going through the pandemic, and this was happening well before the pandemic, where banking aside for a second, you had, the Amazons and the Walmarts and these big behemoths beginning just to eat up, opportunity from small business. And then we had the pandemic hit, where we shut down the non-essential parts of the economy, which were all the small businesses, and we let these guys basically get all of the commerce. So to your point, that's the rule book we're playing by right now, right? We didn't have a discussion about it. We're not really debating, is that a destination we want to end up at, where everything is mega concentrated at the end? So yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and per your point, that's exactly what happened in the pandemic. And then it got even worse with supply chain snarls and with inflation, because that, of course, both of those have hurt small businesses far more than they've hurt large businesses. Large businesses could get space on the container ships and small businesses couldn't. And large businesses are hurt by the cost by inflation, but not as much as small businesses are. So every single thing seems to conspire against the small. And if we were doing that as a deliberate matter of policy, okay, let's talk about what the costs of that are. But it doesn't seem that we are. It seems that it's just what's easiest in the current economy. And then, as you and I have been talking about, why is that what's easiest? Why is our system set up so that seems to be the only way out? I don't know.
Right. And going back to our earlier discussion about hollowing out of employment, right? I mean, the small businesses are the vast majority of the jobs providers, right? So as they get hollowed out, there's a lot less opportunity per capita for people out there to find jobs, right?
So this is not my idea. It came from a really smart person I was talking to recently, but he made the point that we have always relied on small business to lead us out of a recession, because it is small businesses that create most of the jobs. So if we're if we are heading into a recession and we're trying to rely again on small business to lead us out at the very time where we're stopping the flow of credit to small businesses because small banks are terrified to extend loans for fear that they're going to have a run. What does that mean for our economy? And again, if we're thinking through it and we've got another solution, or we've just decided small business go off and die, okay. But I don't think we're thinking through it.
Yeah. Well, let's tug on that thread for a second, and I then we'll have to come back because there are a few other questions I have on banking for you. But let's go into the Fed, which is another area that you look at. The Fed has hiked rates more aggressively than in history, I think, when you look at the altitude that they've gained in the short period of time. Talked a lot about on this program how, in many ways, that's sort of like, you know, throwing somebody off a ship in the Arctic Ocean, right, where they just get this instant hypothermic shock, right? Because their temperature has just changed so dramatically. We've just ramped up the cost of capital, right? And, we're now hanging out above 5% right now in the Fed funds rate. Bullard today just said that he thinks there could be two more rate hikes going from here. Powell has said rate cuts, not on my radar for 2023, right? And he's planning on, keeping things higher for longer, right? And maybe even with Bullard, maybe even a little higher for maybe even a little longer. We're going to find out. But that is a much higher cost of capital than the economy has had to deal with in a long time, right? It's an economy that really habituated to close to ZERP, right? And so the question is like, how long can the wheels stay on with a cost of capital this high? And then, of course, we have the bank lending standards that have tightened post the bank failures we've been talking about, and Powell himself has admitted those act as additional rate hikes on top of what the Fed is already doing here, right? So I think that there's a big danger here that the system really starts kind of the gravitational pull on the system just becomes so strong, the system just has to start kind of, I won't use the word breaking down, but maybe some might. How concerned or what do you think is likely to happen given where the cost of capital is these days?
Well, I think there are a few separate arguments in here, and one is what the Fed rate hikes mean in the short term and whether the economy can bear the rapid rise in rates without things starting to break. And I think we've seen evidence that that's not the case. And I just don't know. I'm not great at predictions, and I really don't think anybody knows. I had interviewed Lael Brainard in Chicago a few months back, and the Fed was, this is kind of funny, the Fed, I guess, at that point was telegraphing that it was going to stop interest rate increases, or at least slow the pace of them, because it looked at that point briefly like inflation was under control. And I'm so unskilled in Fed speak that I didn't even get that, which that was what she was saying when I interviewed her. It wasn't until I read reporters' interpretation of her remarks that I was like, oh,
that's what she was saying.
to settle for me. I'm not skilled in Fed speak anyway, but so I don't think the Fed really knows, to be honest. And they're trying to reassert credibility and authority and reclaim expertise, and thus they've lost a lot of it. And I don't think anybody knows where this is going in the short term is my point. But in the longer term, I also think there's a separate question about what is a healthy level of interest rates. I mean, yeah, rates are higher now than they've been in a really long time. And none of us, very few of us, have been around in an environment of rising interest rates like this. But rates are really, really low by historical standards, or certainly by the standards of the 1970s, right? And isn't in some ways a 5% interest rate healthier? I mean, we all agreed that ZERP was unhealthy. It wasn't supposed to be sustainable. It wasn't supposed to be forever. But some of the very business people who complained about Federal Reserve policy and the unsustainability of ultra low interest rates and QE are now out there saying, if the Fed doesn't stop raising interest rates, it's going to break the economy. And I think, well, what's the right answer? Isn't it, again, important here to have a sense of where are we headed? Because in some ways, a 5% interest rates are healthier, right? Savers can earn a return on their money.
Right.
It's easier for those living on a fixed income to be able to figure out how they're going to live. It's easier for pension plans to be to deliver a decent return and not be so dependent on the whims of the stock market if you have a fixed income market that is delivering a return. So I think there are two questions. What are the near-term costs to what the Fed is doing? And what else might break as a result? And what's the right long term? What's the right long term? But the first one is also complicated by the fact that you have a lot of people out there in the market who thought they were really brilliant because they could invest in an era of falling interest rates and in an era of 0% interest rates, and they have absolutely no clue what to do in a time of higher interest rates or in a time of rising interest rates. And that's a whole nother layer of like, what the hell is going to happen? Because
And I would say that is almost everybody,
you have a
right?
lot of you have a lot of what's the old saying? It's not what you don't it's not what you it's Mark Twain, I think. It's not what you don't know that's going to hurt you. It's what you think you know that just ain't so.
It's what you
Right.
know for sure that just ain't so.
There are a lot of people out there who think they're really, really brilliant because it was really easy to make money over the last couple of decades, and they might be about to find out, or they have found out in the past year that maybe they're not as smart as they thought they were. And that's appealing in some ways, but it may not be really good for all of us either if those people.
Well, and so that's sort of the nature of the question here, which is I really appreciate the point you make because I totally agree with it. And Grant Williams just made this point most recently of the many that are, which is, hey, the problem is not 5% interest rates. The problem was the ZERP for as long as that we had it for, right? We created this system that got habituated to fantasy, right? To basically to sort of, cheap money for everyone and a Fed put where the Fed would step in and quell any issue at any point in time, right? So to your point, that was toxic for a lot of reasons. I've railed about on this program where everybody, you punish savers and everybody got pushed out sort of at sword point onto the pirate ship plank of having to go out the risk curve. Into many cases, people were in assets they had no business being in, but they felt they had to be in them to get any kind of return, right? And so, yeah, I think we could have a really interesting, healthy discussion because I don't even know, what I think the ideal interest rate would be, but it's probably much more in this territory than it is at 0%, right? The point is that just living in the world that we live in, we've just taken a world that's been addicted to that, and we've, forced it to go cold turkey, and what's going to happen, right? And so again, how worried are you about making it to the end of this year if Powell sticks to his guns? What do you think the collateral damage of these higher cost of capital rates are going to be?
I wish I had a great answer for you. I just don't know. There are so many people who are looking at this, and I tend to believe most of the time that the problems are not where we're looking. And so, because we're all thinking about this and wondering what the collateral damage might be, I tend to think it's going to be there are lots of subterranean quakes that are happening as we're speaking, and one of those is going to become the next big bad thing. But I doubt it's anything that anybody would see in advance. I mean, you even think one of the fascinating things about the banking crisis is that we all worried about. I worried about a part of the book I've just written about is the growth in shadow banking, right? And everybody expected the problems to come from somewhere in the shadow banking system. Maybe the enormous buildup in collateralized loan obligations that private equity companies have been using in order to do their increasingly bigger deals. I don't know, but I think we all thought that's where the problem would come. And no, the problem came in the regulated banking system. Go figure. So it just that one of the danger that one of the dangerous things about being in the prediction game is that at least in the last since I've been writing about financial markets, the thing that happens, the big bad thing that happens, is just not where anybody was looking. It never
Yeah,
is.
it's what is it? It's the bullet that kills you is the one that you didn't see coming, right?
Right. And so I think there's a big risk that something happens, but where it would be, I don't know. I worry a lot, and this is a slower problem. I worry a lot that one casualty of the Fed's interest rate increases is going to be private equity firms. And I don't worry for the private equity firms, to be clear. I worry for their investors, who are a lot of the country's pension plans, who are depending on the returns made by private equity funds to be able to pay their pensioners. And in my view, and I've not seen analysis that would corroborate this 100%, it's more based on observation, but the private equity business model really shifted from the early years when it was, yes, built on debt, but also had a lot to do with making the company's operations better and leaner. And that was how you made your money. And it really became a game of financial engineering over the last decades with rising interest rates, where the game was, how do you do dividend recapitalizations and load as much money on in debt onto the backs of this company as you can in order to extract the money you need to pay your investors? In a time of rising interest rates, that game is over. And what does that mean for the returns private equity funds are able to deliver? And I've still not seen a good piece of analysis that would show the percentage of returns that have come from things like dividend analysis. But a guy named Dan Rasmussen, who's really smart, he's an XP guy himself and runs a firm named Verdad Capital, did analysis in American Affairs a couple of years back showing that most of the returns private equity was making came from debt. They came from adding debt to, they didn't come from improving the business or streamlining it or from growth. They came from debt.
Right. They hollowed out these companies, right? Yeah. And then oftentimes the exit would be you flip it to an IPO and you just dump it on the unsuspecting public, right?
Or it's a game of musical chairs, because it would also be you flip it to another private equity owner who then comes up with more ways to extract more money, because if interest rates are falling, then you can put more debt on the thing.
Right.
And what I hate about, I mean, this does tie back to the beginning of our conversation. What I hate about this is that what private equity firms have successfully been able to do in instances, whether it was attempting to get access to the CARES Act, but in other cases has been to go to the government and say, but wait, our investors are all the big pension funds. And if we stumble and fall, they can't pay their pension. They can't pay the pensions. And I hate that that's the way it works, because that just, it seems so unfair that they've made, private equity honchos have made fortunes for themselves. And yet now they get to say, but we'll take the little people down with us. And the problem is, it's true. It's the same thing as the venture capitalists in the Silicon Valley Bank run, right? That wasn't a bailout of Silicon Valley Bank. It was a bailout of the venture capital.
The VCs, yeah.
And they were able to go to regulators in Washington and say, but if you take us down, you're going to take down all these companies and you're going to take down all these employees. So you can't do it. Got to save us. And they were right. And I, but the fact that they're right doesn't change the fact that I find it really, really upsetting.
Right. This is that privatization of gains, socialization of losses that just makes the regular person just so, justifiably angry, right?
Angry.
So, I wish we had another hour, because you've unlocked like five different great topics. So I've had some folks on this channel, Stephanie Pomboy most recently, really ringing loudly the warning bell over the pension system. I'm just curious, based upon your research of the private equity world, how vulnerable do you see the pension system being right now? I mean, there's so many different shoes to drop that I think could really hurt pensions that I almost can't list them all, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
It was horribly vulnerable even before the pandemic. And you had, as a result, again, a casualty or a consequence of Federal Reserve policy was pension funds increasingly putting money into private equity, because private equity promised them these great promised. Touted these fantastic returns, and private equity touted the ability to smooth the returns, because you don't, a private equity firm doesn't have to mark down
its market,
right? They can pretend for a while. And if you're running a pension plan and you don't have to go to your boss and say, we just lost 30%, you can say we lost 10% because your underlying PE investment hasn't yet marked down its investments. Great. That's good for everybody, until it's not. And so I worry a lot about that, because talking about societal instability, if this crisis really does come home to roost and you have pension funds that can't pay benefits, then we have a real problem. We have a real problem with how people are going to live, how they're going to pay their bills. We have a real societal problem in terms of a breakdown of trust in the system. And so that is my biggest worry out there.
Okay. That's really saying something. All right. Two questions that are unfair to ask you with so little time. So I'll just take your quick answer and then we'll wrap things up. What odds do you give us of avoiding recession in the next 6 to 12 months?
You are asking the wrong person. I'm trying to be better and better about saying, I really don't know, because it's easy to start making up answers. And so as part of my own discipline, I'm trying to be really clear about saying, I just don't know. I always tilt toward the pessimistic, and I recognize my biases. So I would say the odds aren't good. We're gonna be in a recession. But really, anybody hearing me say that should take that with a grain of salt, both because I don't know, I'm not an economist, I'm just a journalist, and because my bias is toward the pessimistic.
Okay. All right. I was going to ask you a similar question about the markets. I think we'll probably have a similar answer. So let's not even worry about that. Two lightning fast questions, I'm sure people were wondering when you mentioned both. One, you said you gave some props to Jamie Dimon, saying, look, if somebody were going to be running a huge swath of the banking system, he's the right guy for the job. Real quick, why?
Because he's straightforward and knows how to admit weaknesses and how to manage people. And he's not arrogant. And he knows what he's doing. He knows how to run a business. I think the proof is in the pudding of JP Morgan's performance.
Okay. And then secondly, you mentioned the shadow banking system briefly. You gave private equity as one example of that. People hear that term a lot, but they don't necessarily know what's meant by it. Could you just give a quick definition of how you define the shadow banking system?
Sure. And I probably use the term a little bit loosely, because I use it to encompass both non-banks and the actual shadow banking system. But I think of the shadow banking system as anybody who is providing credit providing bank-like credit that is outside of the regulated financial system, but yet is an incredibly important part of the provision of credit in our society, and ends up in a crisis being under the rubric of the regulated of the Federal Reserve. So money market funds, to me, are a classic example of shadow banking, because they're an incredibly important part of our system of providing credit. They're not supposed to be guaranteed by the government. But when there's a problem, both in the 2008 financial crisis and in the pandemic, the government has to step in to save money market funds. I think about the whole existence of dollar-denominated debt outside the U.S. The Fed has had, in both the 2008 financial crisis and in the pandemic, extend credit lines to central banks around the world, because they have to be able to extend dollar-denominated debt to their constituents, who are otherwise everybody's going to have to start selling treasuries in order to raise cash. So it's this whole system of stuff that is not supposed to be under the purview of the Federal Reserve, but becomes something the Fed has to bail out when there's a crisis.
Okay, so what you just described there at the end of your example was the euro-dollar market, right?
Yeah, it's more than that.
It's
this giant shadowy network. I tried to start figuring it out for this book and kind of gave up because it was a rabbit hole. But it's this giant shadowy thing. This guy named David Beckworth at the Mercatus Center has done a lot of work on it. It's this giant shadowy system of interconnections that are really pivotal to the functioning of the financial markets.
And then you use the term non-bank. Could you just give an example of one or two really important non-bank entities out there, so folks know what you're talking about?
So I would have thought of Countrywide as a non-bank, right? A company that was in the business of providing mortgages, which is a bank-like activity. And you can argue, is this shadow banking? What's the line between a non-bank and shadow banking? But a company that is a huge part of the financial system in what it does, but it's not a regulated bank.
All right, great. Thanks for entertaining me with those questions, but those are helpful for folks to follow what we're doing here. All right, so in wrapping up here, Bethany, thank you. This has been a great discussion. Like I said, it went into all sorts of corners I didn't expect it was going to, but it's been really fascinating. We've intimated a couple of times that you have just finished a book. I just want to give you a chance to give folks a heads up about what that book's about, and when it comes out later on in the year, we'll have you back on the program to really dive deep into its material.
I would love that. Thank you. So it's called The Big Fail, What the Pandemic Reveals About Who America Helps and Who It Leaves Behind. And I guess broadly, it is applicable to a lot of the things we talked about today. I wrote it with Joe Nocera, who edited The Smartest Guys in the Room and with whom I co-authored All the Devils Are Here. And it's really, I guess the thesis of the book is that the pandemic both exposed and exacerbated flaws in our society and in how capitalism is working. It didn't so much cause them as it exposed them. So it's about the hospital system. It's about the influence of private equity in healthcare. It's about Federal Reserve policy. It's about supply chain chains and how they got squeezed in the name of short-term profits. And it is about lockdown policies and who they helped and who they hurt and why they were done in the absence of any scientific evidence that they actually worked.
All right. Well, look, Bethany,
it'll make everybody mad, basically.
Well, it's super topical. And I know we have a lot of folks watching this video who'll be super interested in that. So for folks that just can't wait until the book comes out and would like to follow you and your work in the interim, where should they go?
Let's see. The best place is probably at BethanyMack12 on Twitter. You can also reach me on LinkedIn. I look at messages and see them when they come in on LinkedIn. Those are probably the best places.
All right, great. Well, look, Bethany, thanks so much. I just want to let folks remind viewers too, a lot of the issues that we just talked about here, you know, they make it challenging and hard to navigate the markets from an investing standpoint. You know, we talked a lot about sort of the macro factors, but they definitely end up impacting the markets. As usual, I'll just reiterate my strong feedback that you should be working, most people should be working under the guidance of a professional financial advisor in general, but certainly one that takes all the factors that Bethany and I have discussed on this program into account when putting together their portfolio strategy. If you have one who's already doing that for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, consider scheduling a free consultation with the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. To set up that free consultation, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. Only takes a couple seconds. Again, totally free, no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a public service they offer to help people position prudently in this quite crazy investing climate that we're in right now. All right, Bethany, I want to thank you so much again. This was wonderful. Folks, if you'd like Bethany to come back on this program again when her book comes out, please do us a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. It's been a joy, Bethany. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great day. Bye.
Thank you.